This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Never Caught. The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge, by Erica Armstrong Dunbar. Read by Robin Miles.
Author's Note. I met Ona Judge Staines in the archives about 20 years ago. I was busy conducting research on a different project about 19th century black women in Philadelphia, and I came across an advertisement about a runaway slave in the Philadelphia Gazette. The fugitive in question was called Ona Judge, and she had escaped from the president's house. I was amazed. I wondered how could it be that I had never heard of this woman? What happened to her? Was George Washington able to reclaim her? I vowed to return to her story. Those of us who research and write about early black women's history understand how very difficult it is to find our subjects in the archives. Enslavement, racism, and sexism often discarded these women from the historical record, and as historians, we are frequently left unsatisfied with scant evidence. Much of the earlier historical record was written by other people, typically white men, who were literate and in positions of power. Fortunately, Ona Judge Staines left the world just a bit of her voice, and hopefully, time will reveal new information about this incredible woman. Although she remained in hiding for more than half a century, I don't believe that she ever wanted to be forgotten. Foreword. Spring rain drenched the streets of Philadelphia in 1796. Weather in the city of brotherly love was often fickle this time of year, vacillating between extreme cold and oppressive heat. But rain was almost always appreciated in the nation's capital. It erased the putrid smells of rotting food, animal waste, and filth that permeated the cobblestone streets of the new nation. It reminded Philadelphians that the long and punishing winter was behind them. It cleansed the streets and souls of Philadelphia, ushering in optimism, hope, and a feeling of rebirth. In the midst of the promises of spring, Ona Judge, a young black slave woman, received devastating news. She was to leave Philadelphia, a city that had become her home. Judge was to travel back to her birthplace of Virginia, and prepare to be bequeathed to her owner's granddaughter. Judge had watched 6 spring seasons come and go in Philadelphia. Each spring she watched the rain fall on a city that was slowly cleansing itself of the stain of slavery. She watched a burgeoning free black population grow such that, by the end of the century, it would count nearly 6,000 people. Although a slave, Judge lived among free people, watching black entrepreneurs sell, along with other provisions, their fruits, oysters, and pepper pot soup in the streets. On Sunday morning, she witnessed the newly erected Bethel Church welcome its small but growing black membership. And what she didn't witness firsthand, she would have heard about. Stories about organizations such as the Philadelphia Abolition Society, who helped enslaved men and women find or protect their freedom. And beyond. Philadelphia represented the epicenter of emancipation, allowing black men and women the opportunity to sample a few of the benefits that accompanied a free status. As a slave in Philadelphia, Ona Judge was actually in the minority. In 1796, fewer than 100 slaves lived within the city limits. Not only did her status as an enslaved person separate her from the majority of free black Philadelphians, but she was further distinguished by the family she served. Judge was owned by the first president of the United States and his wife, George and Martha Washington. Judge's sojourn from Mount Vernon in rural Virginia to the north began in 1789 when she accompanied the presidential family to New York, the site of the nation's first capital. In November of 1790, the capital moved to Philadelphia, where Judge encountered a new world, one in which, on occasion, she strolled through the streets, visited the market, and attended the theater without her owners. The rigid laws of Southern slaveholding were difficult to integrate into a free Philadelphia, and when told she'd be given away to the famously mercurial granddaughter of the First Lady, she made a very dangerous and bold decision. She would run away from her owners. On Saturday, May 21st, 1796, at the age of 22, Ona Judge slipped out of the president's mansion in Philadelphia, never to return. Very few 18th century slaves have shared their stories about the institution and experience of slavery. The violence required to feed the system of human bondage often made enslaved men and women want to forget their pasts, not recollect them. For fugitives like Ona Judge, secrecy was a necessity. Enslaved men and women on the run often kept their pasts hidden, even from the people they loved the most, their spouses and children. Sometimes, the nightmare of human bondage, the murder, rape, dismemberment, and constant degradation was simply too terrible to speak of. But it was the threat of capture and re-enslavement that kept closed the mouths of those who managed to beat the odds and successfully escape. Afraid of being returned to her owners, Judge lived a shadowy life that was isolated and clandestine. For almost 50 years, the fugitive slave woman kept to herself, building a family and a new life upon the quicksand of her legal enslavement. She lived most of her time as a fugitive in Greenland, New Hampshire, a tiny community just outside the city of Portsmouth. At the end of her life, Ona Judge made another bold decision. She would tell her story. She granted interviews to two reporters for abolitionist newspapers, the first of which, with Thomas H. Archibald, appeared in the Granite Freeman in May of 1845, almost 49 years to the day of her escape. Judge's second and final interview appeared in 1847 on New Year's Day in the Liberator, the nation's most powerful abolitionist newspaper. Judge's interviews are quite possibly the only existing recorded narratives of an 18th century Virginia fugitive. Her oral testimony allows us to learn about the institution of slavery, not only through the lens of white abolitionists and slave owners, but through the voice of a fugitive. It is my pleasure, indeed an honor, to reintroduce Ona Judge Staines, the Washington's runaway slave. 1. Betty's daughter. In June of 1773, the unimaginable happened. It snowed in Virginia. During the first week of June, the typical stifling heat that almost always blanketed Virginia had not yet laid its claim on the colony. Daytime temperatures fluctuated from sultry warmth to a rainy chill during the first few days of the month. Even more peculiar yet, on June 11th, it snowed. As he did most days, Colonel George Washington sat down and recorded the unusual weather, writing, "Cloudy and exceeding cold wind, fresh from the northwest, and snowing." His diary went on to note, "Memorandum, be it remembered that on the 11th day of June in the year 1773, it rained, hailed, snowed, and was very cold." The men and women who lived on George and Martha Washington's estate must have marveled at the peculiar snow. But whatever excitement the unusual weather brought was most certainly replaced by concern. Shabby clothing and uninsulated slave cabins turned winter into long periods of dread for the enslaved men and women at Mount Vernon and across the colony of Virginia. Although the intense heat of summer brought its own difficulties, winter brought sickness, long periods of isolation, and heightened opportunities for the auction block. To exacerbate matters, the selling of slaves frequently occurred at the beginning of the year, connecting the winter month of January to a fear of deep and permanent loss. The snow in June, then, could only be a sign of very bad things to come. For nearly 150 slaves who labored on the Mount Vernon estate in 1773, a mixture of superstition, African religious practices, and English beliefs in witchery must have intensified a sense of fear. Things that were inconsistent with nature were interpreted as bad omens, commonly bringing drought, pestilence, and death. As for what this snow portended, only time would tell. Sure enough, 8 days after the snow fell, Martha Park Custis, daughter of Martha Washington, fell terribly ill. The stepdaughter of George Washington, just 17, had long struggled with a medical condition that rendered her incapable of controlling her body. Plagued by seizures that began during her teenage years, Patsy Custis most likely suffered from epilepsy. The early discipline of medicine was far from mature, offering few options for cures outside of bleeding and purges. Her parents had spent the last 5 years consulting with doctors and experimenting with unhelpful medicinal potions, diet, exercise modifications, and, of course, deep prayer. Their faith was tested on June 19th, when Patsy Custis and a host of invited family members were finishing up with dinner a little after 4 o'clock. Although sickly, Washington's stepdaughter had been in better health and spirits than she appeared to have been in for some time. After dinner and quiet conversation with family, Patsy excused herself and went to retrieve a letter from her bedroom. Eleanor Calvert, Patsy's soon-to-be sister-in-law, went to check on the young woman and found her seizing violently on the floor. Patsy was moved to the bed, but there was very little anyone could do. Within 2 minutes, she was gone. The June snow and Patsy's death combined to create an eerie feeling of uncertainty. House slaves understood that Martha Washington would need to be handled with more care than usual, especially since this was not the first child that she had lost. Two of her toddlers had succumbed to the high childhood mortality rates of colonial Virginia, and Patsy's death left the devastated mother with only one living child. George Washington wrote to his nephew, breaking the news of his stepdaughter's death and his wife's emotional distress, stating, "I scarce need add that Patsy's death has almost reduced my poor wife to the lowest ebb of misery." George Washington wasn't the only one attuned to Martha's emotional state. Slave women who worked in the Mansion House tended to the devastated Martha Washington, taking great care to respect their grieving mistress while helping the household prepare for Patsy's funeral. Yet while the mistress, Martha Washington, wept over the loss of her daughter, a slave woman named Betty, also known as Mulatto Betty, prepared for an arrival of her own. Born sometime around 1738, Betty was a dower slave. That is, she was property owned by Martha Washington's first husband, Daniel Park Custis. As a seamstress and expert spinner who was among Mrs. Washington's favored slaves, the bondwoman had a long history with her mistress, one that predated the relationship between Colonel Washington and his wife, and one that had seen Martha endure great heartbreak. In 1757, Betty watched her mistress survive the sudden loss of her first husband, followed by the death of her 4-year-old daughter, Frances. She also watched Martha re-emerge from sorrow's clutch. Betty continued to spin and sew as her mistress took control of the family business, which included 6 plantations and close to 300 slaves that fed Virginia's tobacco economy. With the death of her husband, Martha Park Custis stood in control of over 17,500 acres of land, making her one of the wealthiest widows in the colony of Virginia, if not throughout the entire Chesapeake. Before her move to Mount Vernon, Betty worked in the Custis home known as the White House on the Pamunkey River in New Kent County, Virginia. 2 years after the death of her owner, Betty learned that her mistress was to remarry. She most likely received the news of her mistress's impending second marriage with great wariness, as word spread that Martha Custis's intended was Colonel George Washington. The colonel was a fairly prominent landowner with a respectable career as a military officer and an elected member of the Virginia House of Burgesses. His marriage to the widowed Martha Custis would offer him instant wealth and the stability of a wife and family that had eluded him. For her part, the young widow had managed to secure a surrogate father to help raise her 2 living children. She had also found a partner with whom she could spend the rest of her days. Nevertheless, a huge yet necessary transition awaited Martha Custis as she prepared to marry and move to the Mount Vernon estate nearly 100 miles away. For Betty, as well as the hundreds of other slaves that belonged to the Custis estate, the death of their previous owner and Martha's marriage to George Washington was a reminder of their vulnerability. It was often after the death of an owner that slaves were sold to remedy the debts held by an estate. Betty and all those enslaved at New Kent had no idea what kind of financial transactions would transpire, which families would be split apart, never to be united again. For enslaved women, the moral character of the new owner was also a serious concern. When George and Martha Washington married in January of 1759, Betty was approximately 21 years old and considered to be in the prime of her reproductive years. She was unfamiliar with her new master's preferences, or more importantly, if he would choose to exercise his complete control over her body. All of the enslaved women who would leave for Mount Vernon most likely worried about their new master's protocol regarding sexual relations with his slaves. But of greater consequence for Betty was the future for her young son, Austin. Born sometime around 1757, Austin was a baby or young toddler when his mistress took George Washington's hand in marriage. To lose him before she even got to know him, to have joined the thousands who stood by powerlessly while their children were bartered for gold, as the poet Frances Ellen Watkins Harper wrote, would have been devastating. As she prepared to move to Mount Vernon, Martha Washington selected a number of slaves to accompany her on the journey to Fairfax County. Betty and Austin were, to Betty's relief, among them. The highest valued mother and child pair in a group that counted 155 slaves, they arrived in April of 1759. Betty managed to do what many slave mothers couldn't, keep her son. Austin's very young age would have prohibited the Custis estate from fetching a high price if he were sold independently from his mother. Perhaps this fact, in addition to Betty's prized position in the Custis household, ensured that she would stay connected to her child as she moved away from the place she had called home. As Martha Washington settled into her new life with her second husband at Mount Vernon, a sprawling estate consisting of 5 separate farms, Betty also adapted, continuing her spinning, weaving, tending to her son, and making new family and friends at the plantation. The intricacies of Betty's romantic life at Mount Vernon remain unclear, but what we do know is that more than a decade after giving birth to Austin, Betty welcomed more children into the world. Her son, Tom Davis, was born around 1769, and his sister, Betty Davis, arrived in 1771. Unlike Austin, these 2 children claimed a last name, one that most likely linked them to a hired white weaver named Thomas Davis. George and Martha Washington placed their most valued and favored slaves inside the household. Martha Washington allowed only those slaves she felt to be the most polished and intelligent to toil within the walls of the main house, and that included Betty, whose skills as a clothier ranged from knowledge of expert weaving to the dyeing of expensive and scarce fabric. Betty and a corps of talented enslaved seamstresses not only outfitted their masters, but also stitched together clothing for the hundreds of slaves at Mount Vernon. Now, in 1773, 14 years after she watched her mistress experience the death of her first child, Betty witnessed her mistress come undone once again. The loss of her daughter Patsy left Martha Washington almost inconsolable, and stood in contrast with Betty's relative good fortune. Martha Washington had lost young Francis in 1759, just as Betty was blessed with the arrival of her son Austin. Now, the circumstances were nearly identical, for as Martha Washington grieved over the loss of her daughter, Betty began preparing for the arrival of another child. June snow served as a marker of death for the Washingtons, but issued a very different signal to Betty. It marked the beginning of a life that would be as unusual as summertime winter weather. Sometime around or after the June snow of 1773, Betty gave birth to a daughter named Ona Maria Judge. This girl child would come to represent the complexity of slavery, the limits of black freedom, and the revolutionary sentiments held by many Americans. She would be called Oni. Betty, like other bondwomen, increased her owner's wealth each time she bore a child. Although she called George Washington her master, he owned neither Betty nor her children. As a dower slave, Betty was technically owned by Martha Washington and the Custis estate. The birth of Ona Judge would not add value to George Washington's coffers, but her body would be counted among the human property that would produce great profit for Martha Washington and the Custis children and grandchildren. Similar to Betty's other children, Ona had a surname. It belonged to her father, Andrew Judge, an English-born white man. On July 8, 1772, Andrew Judge found his way to America via an indenture agreement, contracting himself to Alexander Koldeloff, a merchant from Leeds, England. In exchange for his passage to Baltimore or any port in America, as well as a promise of food, clothing, appropriate shelter, and an allowance, Judge handed over 4 years of his life. Although indentured servitude served as the engine for population growth in the early 17th century, Andrew Judge entered into service at a time when fewer and fewer English men agreed to hand over their lives for an opportunity in the colonies. Why did he come? Indenture agreements never made clear the circumstances from which a person was exiting, so it is quite possible that Judge was running from debt or a life of destitution. Whatever the problem, the solution for Judge was life as a servant in the colonies, uncertainty and all. He landed in Alexandria, Virginia, where George Washington purchased his indenture for £30. Mount Vernon relied primarily upon slave labor. However, Washington included a number of white indentured servants in his workforce. White servitude had its advantages, but by the late 18th century, planters like Washington often complained about their unreliability, their tendency for attempted escape, and their laziness. Yet Andrew Judge did not appear as the target of Washington's ire in any of his correspondence. In fact, he became a trusted tailor, relied upon by the colonel for outfitting him at the most important of moments. By 1774, he appeared in the Mount Vernon manager's account book as responsible for creating the blue uniform worn by Washington when he was named Commander-in-Chief of the American Forces. Judge was responsible for making clothing for the entire Washington family, which would have required him to make frequent visits to the main house, where he would come into contact with Betty. In her mid to late 30s, Betty became acquainted with the indentured tailor. Interracial relationships were far from uncommon in Virginia at the time, and many mixed-race children were counted among the enslaved. Perhaps Betty and Andrew Judge flirted with one another, eventually engaging in a mutual affair. Maybe the two bound laborers fell in love. If either of these scenarios were true, Betty probably chose her lover, a most powerful example of agency in the life of an enslaved woman. Understanding the inherited status of slavery, Betty would have known that any child born to her would carry the burden of slavery, that any child she bore would be enslaved. Nonetheless, a union with Andrew Judge could facilitate a road to emancipation for their child, and perhaps for Betty herself. Eventually, Judge would work through his servitude agreement and become a free man. If he saved enough money, he could offer to purchase his progeny as well as Betty and her additional children. Although a legal union in Virginia between a white man and a black woman would not be recognized for almost two centuries, Judge's eventual rise in status out of the ranks of servant to that of a free, landholding white man offered potential power. Andrew Judge may not have been able to marry Betty, but if he loved her, he could try to protect her and her family from the vulnerability of slavery. Love or romance, however, may not have brought the two bound laborers together. Although he was a servant, Andrew Judge was a white man with the power to command or force a sexual relationship with the enslaved Betty. What is lost to us is just how consensual their relationship may have been. Perhaps Judge stalked Betty, eventually forcing himself upon her. As a black woman, she would have virtually no ability to protect herself from unwanted advances or sexual attack. The business of slavery received every new enslaved baby with open arms, no matter the circumstances of conception. What we do know is that their union, whether brief or extended, consensual or unwanted, resulted in the birth of a daughter. We also know that however Judge defined his relationship to his daughter, it wasn't enough to keep him at Mount Vernon. Eventually, Andrew Judge left and built upon the opportunity that indentured servitude promised. By the 1780s, Andrew Judge lived in his own home in Fairfax County. Listed among the occupants of his home were six additional residents, one of whom was black. It's uncertain if Andrew Judge owned a slave, or if he simply hired a free black person who lived on and worked his land. What is clear from the evidence left behind is that Judge left Mount Vernon and his enslaved daughter behind. Perhaps he attempted to purchase Betty and his child, but was refused the opportunity by the Washingtons. Or maybe Judge simply didn't want a complicated relationship with an enslaved woman and a mixed-race daughter. Whatever hope, if any, Betty had placed upon the relationship with Andrew Judge collapsed quickly, leaving her at Mount Vernon to raise Ona and her siblings, including Philadelphia, a daughter she gave birth to after Ona but before Judge left, sometime around 1780. Leaving his child behind at Mount Vernon, Andrew Judge's parting gift to his daughter was a surname and a unique first name. The name is both African and Gaelic, and no other slave at Mount Vernon or the White House on the Pamunkey River was named Ona. Perhaps even more exceptional was that she was given a middle name, Mariah. Her distinctive name set her apart from her siblings and from the majority of the other bondmen and bondwomen who toiled with her in Virginia. The slaves who were directly connected to the work at the Mansion House lived across the road from the blacksmith's forge in the communal space known as the quarters, or house for families. Betty and other women who worked in the Mansion House were typically required to be present from sunrise to sundown, preparing meals, mending clothes, cleaning, spinning, and performing other domestic tasks, leaving most enslaved children separated from their parent or parents most of the day. Many of the children at Mount Vernon began structured labor between the ages of 9 and 14, but most performed odd jobs just as soon as they were physically able. As very young enslaved children were unhelpful and sometimes considered a nuisance, they were often left in the quarters without much supervision beyond the older slave women, who were deemed incapable of working in the fields and no longer up to the task of domestic work. Bushy-haired, with light skin and freckles, a young Ona probably spent some of her days playing with her siblings and other enslaved children in the quarters. More often than not, though, she had to learn how to fend for herself. Judge and the other children at Mount Vernon cried out in loneliness for their parents, witnessed the brutality of whippings and corporal punishment, and fell victim to early death due to accidental fires and drowning. Childhood for enslaved girls and boys was fleeting and fraught with calamity. Many perished before reaching young adulthood. Judge's childhood wasn't shortened by a plantation fatality. Instead, hers ended at age 10 when she was called to serve Martha Washington up at the Mansion House. A good number of children at Mount Vernon did not live with both of their parents, a circumstance created by the separation of enslaved spouses. Washington may not have broken up slave marriages by selling away husbands and wives, but he was not averse to separating slave couples by placing them on different farms. While he may not have purposefully disrupted slave unions, the business of slavery and the needs of Mount Vernon always came first. For slave couples and enslaved families, this meant that they would see each other only when permission was given. Just like other enslaved children, Ona Judge did not spend the majority of her youth with two parents. Andrew Judge had the privilege of white skin and the power anchored in a male body that allowed him to slip away from a life of unpaid labor. Betty had neither gender nor race on her side, and spent the entirety of her life in human bondage in Virginia, a colony that would eventually become the slave-breeding capital of a new nation. Ona Judge learned valuable lessons from both of her parents. From her mother, she would learn the power of perseverance. From her father, Judge would learn that the decision to free oneself trumped everything, no matter who was left behind. 2. New York Bound. On Christmas Eve, 1783, George Washington returned to his family and beloved Mount Vernon, a very changed man. For 8.5 years, Washington had led his countrymen as commander of the Continental Army, a poorly outfitted and undertrained band of men who took on the Herculean fight that many believed would end in failure. It had been a terrible war that lasted far longer than anyone had ever predicted. There were never enough shoes, blankets, or shirts for the men who enlisted. Even gunpowder was hard to come by. General Washington held the lives of more than 100,000 men in his hands, men who had agreed to bear arms in the new Continental Army, men who risked their limbs and lives in order to create a new country. More than 30,000 American soldiers perished in the war, many from direct combat and others from slow-moving disease and infection that ravaged makeshift infirmaries and camp hospitals. Unknown numbers of men died in the most dreadful ways, accidentally shot by comrades, crushed by old and unstable heavy wagons, falls from horses, and accidental drowning. Simply unable to live with the violence of war, some men took their own lives, leaving wives and children to face poverty and starvation. The general was a lucky man. He would return home without the visible markers of war that thousands of his countrymen carried to their graves. Even though he had escaped the ailments that plagued his soldiers, the amputation of legs, blindness, and grotesque facial disfigurement from musket fire, his health was far from stable. Now in his 50s, he had aged considerably. In the 18 months before his return home to Mount Vernon, Washington witnessed the collapse of the mighty British army. After the surprising victory at Yorktown, earnest negotiations began in Paris, resulting in a signed peace treaty and the evacuation of British troops. Washington left his post in New York and headed to Annapolis, Maryland, where he would resign as commander of the Continental Army. He had been home to visit only one time during the Revolution, and he wanted desperately to return to the life he once enjoyed. He missed his wife and longed for the privacy that his estate offered. Having completed his duties, the general looked forward to a restful Christmas holiday with his family and friends, and returned to Virginia with a sense of great accomplishment for doing what most had imagined impossible. He had won the Revolution. But very few Americans had much faith in the new nation, including Washington. The United States of America was fragile. Its infrastructure was anything but secure as the former colonies took their time forming a more cohesive country. Making matters worse, the new nation was on the brink of financial collapse. Dependent upon foreign loans, America was broke. His return to civilian life at Mount Vernon was brief. Washington could not remove himself from the politics and the concerns of the new nation, even when he tried. When invited to serve on Virginia's delegation to the Constitutional Convention, Washington declined. It would take months for friends and political acquaintances to convince the retired general that he must attend the convention in Philadelphia. A reluctant yet duty-bound Washington was unanimously elected as the convention's president, where the new nation's constitution was created. But no one knew if it would work. Washington left Philadelphia and returned to Mount Vernon feeling trapped. He avoided conversation about the possibility of becoming the first president of the United States, dodging questions about his intentions and denying a desire to lead the new nation. But once the Congress set the timetable for the presidential election, Washington had to make his feelings known. Presidential electors were to be chosen in January of 1789, and an election would quickly follow. Washington sent his trusted secretary, Tobias Lear, to New York to establish and secure good housing in the city that would become the nation's first capital. With considerable pressure and reassurance from friends and politicians, Washington had made up his mind. If elected the first president of the United States, he would accept the position. On April 14, 1789, Charles Thompson, Secretary of the Congress, arrived on horseback at Mount Vernon. It was Thompson's responsibility to inform the general that he had been unanimously elected to serve as president, capturing all 69 electoral votes. Thompson read aloud a letter penned by Senator John Langdon of New Hampshire, President pro tempore of the Senate. "Sir, I have the honor to transmit to Your Excellency the information of your unanimous election to the office of the President of the United States of America. Suffer me, sir, to indulge the hope that so auspicious a mark of public confidence will meet your approbation, and be considered a sure pledge of the affection and support you are to expect from a free and enlightened people." For Washington, the letter confirmed that his life would never again be the same, and it set into motion a chain of events that irrevocably altered the lives of George and Martha Washington. The president-elect prepared to leave for New York quickly, but not before borrowing £600 from Captain Richard Conway. Just like the new nation, Washington was cash-strapped. Poor crop harvests and delinquent taxes had placed the soon-to-be leader of the new nation in dire straits. He would need to borrow money at 6% interest to keep Mount Vernon afloat and to finance his trip to New York. All of this weighed heavily on the president-elect's mind as he wrote, "I am inclined to do what I never expected to be reduced to the necessity of doing, that is, to borrow money upon interest." Concerned about his failing plantation, unhappy about a northern relocation, and uncertain about the fragile new nation, Washington left for New York, the seat of the nation's capital, with a great deal on his mind. But he was not the only one with concerns about leaving Mount Vernon. There were others who would travel with the president and his family, people who had no choice in the matter. 7 slaves would accompany the Washingtons to New York, including a 16-year-old Ona Judge. The fear of the unknown, the separation from loved ones, and the forced relocation must have felt apocalyptic for the bond men and bond women who would travel to New York. Not that the cares and concerns of Mount Vernon slaves entered into the mind of the new president. Eager to keep the new nation running, Washington left for New York on April 16th, leaving a tremendous amount of the relocation work in the capable hands of Martha Washington, who would join him later. Prior to his departure, the president selected an acting master and mistress for the Mount Vernon estate. George Augustine Washington, the eldest son of the president's brother Charles, was already living at Mount Vernon, serving as a manager, and was deemed the appropriate choice to fill his uncle's shoes. His wife, Fanny Bassett, the daughter of Martha Washington's sister, would look after all things connected to the running of the house and would remain in close contact with George and Martha Washington via the post. Fear, regret, and concern spilled onto the pages of the president's diary. He wrote of his departure from Mount Vernon not in the fashion of a famed general ready for new challenges, but as a man who was extremely tentative. "About 10 o'clock, I bade adieu to Mount Vernon, to private life, and to domestic felicity, and with a mind oppressed with more anxious and painful sensations than I have words to express." He doubted himself and the enterprise he had already accepted. Washington explained that he had the best dispositions to render service to my country in obedience to its call, but with less hope of answering its expectations. Washington's journey north took him through Philadelphia, where nearly 20,000 men and women lined the streets to greet their new president. The crowds couldn't compensate for the grueling nature of the trip. The muddy roads and constant festivities slowed the pace of travel. By the time Washington arrived in New York, he wanted nothing more than to enter the city as inconspicuously as possible and to begin his work leading the new nation. Washington wrote to New York Governor George Clinton, stating, "I can assure you with the utmost sincerity that no reception can be so congenial to my feelings as a quiet entry devoid of ceremony." Although the governor offered the president lodging in his private home until a residence was secured for the new first family, a more modern term not used in the 18th century, Washington declined the offer, stating that it was simply too much of an imposition. The president planned to take hired lodgings or rooms in a tavern until the details of the Washington's new home were settled. Just 1 week before his arrival, the Congress leased a home for the president at 3 Cherry Street, located in what was then the northeastern section of the city, very near the present-day Brooklyn Bridge. Washington began the work of leading the new nation in a city that was very different from his Mount Vernon home. By the late 1780s, New York was the second largest city in America, with a population of about 30,000 people, and it was characteristically American. The city displayed signs of opulence and wealth, all while maintaining a parochial nature that allowed for great diversity within its public spaces. People from all walks of life found themselves conducting business on the cobblestone streets. Men, women, white, black, enslaved, and free, all resided within the city limits, adding richness to a bustling commercial port city. The streets of New York could be adventurous and filled with opportunity, but they could also be rough terrain to navigate. On April 30th, 1789, George Washington took the oath of office and issued an inaugural address from the balcony of New York's Federal Hall. Notably absent from the ceremony was his wife. While the First Lady had traveled to see her husband during the American Revolution as he led the colonists in battle against the British, she wanted nothing more than to stay put and resented her husband's call to public service that was taking them away from their Virginia home. For his part, though he had spent a great deal of time separated from his wife over the course of the previous decade, it wasn't his preference. The new president missed having his wife by his side and began to wonder just how long it would take for Mrs. Washington to arrive in New York. She was certainly taking her time. Rather than immediately traveling to New York, she remained at Mount Vernon, attempting to come to grips with the path of her new life, one that would keep her away from her Virginia home for many years. Unsettled and displeased about the move to the nation's capital, she expressed her discontent to her closest confidants and stalled for time. Even the president's trusted secretary got involved. On May 3rd, Tobias Lear wrote to George Augustine describing the new home on Cherry Street and offering bits of information that might entice Mrs. Washington to hurry along in her journey north. Lear wrote that they had hired Black Sam as steward and superintendent of the kitchen, and a very excellent fellow he is in the latter department. Lear knew that the First Lady enjoyed seafood, and so he reported on the culinary wonders performed by the head chef, hoping that it would hasten her advancing towards New York. The president's secretary made it clear that everyone was awaiting the arrival of the First Lady. He wrote, "For we are extremely desirous of seeing her here." In convincing Martha Washington that there was much to look forward to, he had his work cut out for him. The slaves at Mount Vernon knew all too well about the displeasure of their mistress and had to add that to their list of concerns. Ona Judge in particular, one of the favored house slaves responsible for tending to her mistress's needs, both emotional and physical, had to balance the First Lady's deep sadness, resentment, and frustration with her own fears about the move. The young Ona Judge was far from an experienced traveler. The teenager knew only Mount Vernon and its surroundings and had never traveled far from her family and loved ones. For Judge, the move must have been similar to the dreaded auction block. Although she was not to be sold to a different owner, she was forced to leave her family for an unfamiliar destination hundreds of miles away. Judge would have had no choice but to stifle the terror she felt and go on about the work of preparing to move. Folding linens, packing Martha Washington's dresses and personal accessories, and helping with the grandchildren were the tasks at hand, and it wasn't her place to complain or question. Judge had to remain strong and steady, if not for herself, then for her mistress, who appeared to be falling apart at the seams. Like Judge, Martha Washington had no choice about the move to New York. Her life was at the direction of her husband, who was now the most powerful man in the country. Mrs. Washington and Ona Judge may have shared similar concerns, but of course only Martha Washington was allowed to express discontent and sorrow. Martha Washington was unhappy, and everyone knew it, including her frightened slave. The president's nephew, Robert Lewis, would also soon be made aware of it. When he arrived at the estate on May 14th, things were in disarray. Lewis, who served as Washington's secretary between 1789 and 1791, was chosen to escort his aunt and her grandchildren to New York, but was surprised and a bit concerned when he arrived to find a frenzied and hectic scene. Lewis wrote, "Everything appeared to be in confusion, the manifestation of Mrs. Washington's conflicting feelings." Robert Lewis described the departure, which finally took place on May 16th, 1789, as an emotional moment for the slaves and the First Lady. "After an early dinner and making all necessary arrangements in which we were greatly retarded, it brought us to 3 o'clock in the afternoon when we left Mount V, the servants of the house, and a number of the field Negroes made their appearance to take leave of their mistress. Numbers of these poor wretches seemed greatly agitated, much affected. My aunt equally so. Betty, Ona Judge's mother, must have been one of those agitated slaves. Not only was she losing her 16-year-old daughter, but she was also losing her son, Austin, who would serve as one of the Washington's waiters. Austin's wife, Charlotte, and their children would have joined in the morning. Betty watched her children leave Mount Vernon, a reminder of what little control slave mothers had over the lives of their children. If she found any comfort that day, it would have been that brother and sister were traveling together. Austin was older and male and could look out for his younger sister. Still, Betty knew that her relationship with her children would never be the same. The grieving mother was not the only slave to wrestle with a feeling of dread at the sight of her mistress's departure. Every slave on the Mount Vernon estate knew that the order of things was in transition. With George and Martha Washington hundreds of miles away, their lives were now in the hands of George Augustine and the overseers. Would the slaves at Mount Vernon be treated decently? Would the nature of their work change, and if so, how? The uncertainty of life and the involuntary separation of family members reminded every black person at Mount Vernon that the system of slavery rendered them powerless. Not everyone was disturbed with the plans for northern living, however. Traveling north may have also stirred some feelings of hope or excitement in the minds of the slaves who were chosen to accompany the Washingtons. Freedom and opportunity were at play in many northern states that boasted growing free black populations. News about northern emancipation reached the information-hungry slave communities of the South, often prompting slaves to risk everything and attempt escape. The Commonwealths of Pennsylvania and Massachusetts had already loosened the shackles of slavery through gradual abolition laws, while New York struggled with such decisions. Just a year prior, in 1788, Connecticut and Massachusetts forbade its residents from participating in the slave trade, but New York enacted a new comprehensive slave law, one that kept all slaves currently held in bondage as slaves for the entirety of their lives. It is impossible to know how familiar the slaves at Mount Vernon were with the specifics of the changing laws of the North, of one state's mandate versus another's. But what is certain is that Judge had witnessed the act of running away. The slaves at Mount Vernon who successfully escaped reminded the bond people who remained that there were alternatives to the dehumanizing experience of slavery. Freedom, of course, was risky and was never considered without great caution and planning, but perhaps a trip to New York would yield opportunities never imagined by the slaves who lived at Mount Vernon. Maybe life would be better in New York, and perhaps they could find their way to freedom. As the slaves pondered what the move to New York might mean for them, they did so subtly. A slave could not appear to be too calculating or strategic, and no one wanted to spook the Washingtons, especially the very fragile Martha Washington. The president and his wife were well aware that the practice of slavery was under attack in most of the northern states. They also knew that though New York's residents still clung to bound labor, public sentiment regarding African slavery was changing. Unwilling to even think about abandoning the use of black slaves, the president and the first lady were careful in their selection of men and women who traveled with them from Mount Vernon. Their selections involved only those slaves who were seen as loyal and therefore less likely to attempt escape. Skills in the art of house service were also a necessity. William Lee, the president's body servant, elbowed his way to the front of the line of the bondmen who would travel north. He was Washington's number one slave, the valet who knew the president better than any other enslaved person at Mount Vernon. Born circa 1750, William Lee was a teenager when he was purchased by George Washington. Sold alongside three other slaves, Lee earned the position as butler in part because of his complexion. Believing that interracial slaves were more attractive and intelligent, Washington preferred to buy yellow-skinned men and women. Lee was offered fine clothing and learned the art of caring for his master from older, more seasoned house slaves. He would perfect his duty of dressing his master's hair and preparing his clothing. Washington's manservant also became known for his expertise in writing, an activity much enjoyed by his master. The trusted bondman was noted as a fearless horseman who was sturdy and of great bone and muscle. Washington and Lee would ride together several times a week, forming the closest kind of relationship appropriate for a master and slave. Once Washington announced that he would accept the position of president and move to New York, William Lee was determined to go with him. Lee had traveled north once before, albeit to Philadelphia for the Continental Congress 15 years earlier, not New York, and good memories must have prompted him to want to return. For it was during his first northern sojourn that Lee found both his voice and love. While we know virtually nothing about Lee's first experience in the North, other than the fact that Washington attired him in new shoes and garments, we can surmise that the trip changed him. Prior to leaving Mount Vernon, members of George and Martha Washington's family often referred to Lee as Billy. Washington frequently listed him as "My Boy Billy" in his account books, but Lee returned from the northern city with a proper name, one that he chose on his own. His master wrote that his enslaved valet began calling himself William Lee. Presumably, revolutionary rhetoric at the beginnings of black freedom in the North affected Lee, giving him the impetus to move away from the nickname of Billy and to adopt the surname that directly tied him to the plantation on which he was born. Not only did William Lee name himself after that trip to Philadelphia, but in doing so, he openly connected himself to his former owner, whom he must have considered to be his biological father. However, it was his meeting and courtship with Margaret Thomas, a free black woman in Philadelphia, that changed Lee's life. The couple requested that they be kept together, and Margaret Thomas made the odd and dangerous decision to move south with her beloved. Although the marriages of enslaved people were not recognized by the law in Virginia, Washington supposedly granted their request that Thomas be allowed to travel to and live with Lee at Mount Vernon. What happened next is lost. There is no written evidence that Lee and Thomas lived together at Mount Vernon, though as a free woman, she would not have appeared in Washington's account book. It is possible that she either died or left the marriage. What's more probable is that Thomas changed her mind about exchanging what little stability she had in Philadelphia for dangerous uncertainty in Virginia. By leaving Philadelphia, Thomas would have walked into the mouth of the slave-hungry South, placing her free status in serious jeopardy. In this instance, perhaps, love was not a strong enough pull to compete with freedom. Lee's chance for love with a free woman and a future complete with free heirs never came to fruition. Still, he was marked by this experience, and he was keen, indeed determined, to travel to New York with his master. Lee's desperate wish to travel to New York was in danger, however, because of his failing health. In April of 1785, Lee was injured during a surveying expedition and broke the pan of his knee. Reduced to hobbling around on crutches or a cane, Lee dealt with his constant pain through the consumption of alcohol, and lots of it. 3 years later, on a cold and snowy day in March, Lee was sent to fetch the mail from Alexandria. During his errand, the already disabled slave fell again, this time shattering the other knee. His body was broken, and his usefulness was lost. Lee became somewhat of an invalid, unable to perform any tasks that required him to walk or move. In his late 30s, Lee's duties shifted to that of a shoemaker, a demotion. Fortunately,